to meet that creativity, that potential creativity, you're going to suffocate. And that's kind of the way I look at money. It's more like air responding to the potential of our...
That's the right way. That's the way we want it to be. But, you know, what happens when somebody has to wear a mask because of pollution and they're not allowed to run because they don't have the oxygen?
Right. That's not my state. My question is, and I may have maybe the way you phrase it could be misinterpreted, but there's also another side to the equation. You say that government spending is consumption in some sense, but it can also be the prevention of the destruction of value. So if we have healthcare, we're consuming that, but that's allowing us to continue to be productive. Or education prevents destruction of our creative potential. So I think government spending is maybe in some ways preventing a negative, but it's just on the other side of the equation. It's adding value by preventing value from being taken away, by releasing the full potential of civilization.
I want to honor what you said, and I want to say also that you've thought about that. It's more complicated than you could convey. I'll just restate what I'm trying to say is, if you issue money for people to go spend it, and that money doesn't... Now, remember, spending is great because it moves things, it monetizes all the productivity. When a store or a factory has a bunch of inventory that's sitting on the shelves, right? That's a disaster because they're not monetizing the productivity that went into that.
And it rots. So,
yeah. When we buy it and we pull it off the shelf, everybody gets paid who's been waiting for that to move. Right. So that's a good thing. But what I'm just saying is government can invest that money and create new economic values, or it can do things where it gives people purchasing power. And that is basically consuming things that have already been made without creating new things. The productivity is not coming out in the real economy. It starts to get to be, you know, it's a little tricky because we're not saying that it isn't valuable what people do, but we're saying it has an effect on the money supply because you've issued all this money for the courts and things that we care about, but there's not an equal number of economic values to match it, so it affects the purchasing power of those people. Roads, bridges, that's a whole other category. That has no effect on it.
I think the courts are just as valuable as roads and bridges from the exact same standpoint, because they facilitate the transportation of commerce and the legal transportation of commerce. Without the courts, it'd be like having no roads.
Well, I'm not arguing the courts aren't important.
Okay.
But I am noticing that if you invest money and it goes to the Division of Labor, you're actually creating capital. And that's not the same thing as having a court system. It's like, remember when I said the farmer and they wanted a teacher? Well, now they decide they can have the teacher, they're doing better, and they can have teachers full time. Well, now guess what? They're doing better. Now they want a priest. In fact, they usually have the priest before the teacher, but now they have a church. So they all produce, and what do? They take some of what they produce and they give it to the priest because they want the guy to live, right? They want to support him. And in fact, they want to support his vision, which is bigger buildings, more people, whatever. There's no values judgment here. I'm just saying that priest isn't producing. It's valuable. It's extremely valuable. There's a real esoteric argument, but I think an important one that says our cultural life is really important and enhances our productivity in our economic life. Otherwise, we just turn into little machines, and that's draining, and we become unproductive. That's a little esoteric. We'll throw it to the side. But coming back to the priest, I'm not saying that courts aren't valuable. What I'm saying is courts aren't producing economic values through the division of labor. You could argue, well, courts keep the market running smoothly, right? They allow for us to resolve this differences without shooting each other, right? They have their function. They manage the right sphere, and it's absolutely critical that somebody comes out and paints the white lines on the field and has a rule book and says, this is how our social life, we're going to mediate it. Like, that's super critical. I'm in no way diminishing them, but it's not economic. It's not creating economic values. It's consuming them, right? We're giving the courts and everybody there purchasing power to go out and buy bread and grain and all these other things. So it does, this is one of those gray areas where, you know, they do create value. It's not zero, right? Because you need a functioning market, and optimizing the market helps. So it's just saying that there's producing activities and consuming activities. Consuming activities, we are giving people purchasing power, and producing activities, we're capitalizing people and activities, and they're creating economic values. They create the things we eat, we live with, you know. So this is the, you know, so this relationship matters because there's two kinds of ways, if you're going to print money or if you're going to have debt, some activities government do are really economic, like bridges and roads, because they go out and create capital. They create new economic values. So the money you're creating is forward looking for the capital that's going to be created. And that's not the same thing as debt that you run into for the courts and all these other things. Now, maybe you want to raise taxes and pay for it that way, or maybe you want to issue money and slightly dilute the purchasing power and do it that way. That's a social moral quandary that we all have to come to together to figure out what the right way to do it is. And the reality is when you're going to print sovereign money, you're telling people we're going to do that differently.
Hey, John, I think Hover's on the stack. I think my point was is that it's a good way to start the conversation about what government should be paying for so that it's not necessarily crossing over into the free market, which is where the majority of productivity activity. And when I say productivity, I mean there's a consumer paying for a service or paying for some good and productive service. So there's a change of real money. On the other side, you have things like even roads and stuff that in order to pay for the Brooklyn Bridge, if it fell down and we had to rebuild it, the tolls you would have to charge would be enormous. So that's something that government takes on itself to maintain the infrastructure of the highway system and to build bullet trains and other things that aren't necessarily profitable to do. I'm saying that that's a good portion or a good point to start the spending conversation about what government should be creating money to spend on.
Absolutely. And we're structurally underinvesting in those things, which is ruining the market, lowering optimization of productivity for everybody else.
And causing overtaxation and everything else. Go ahead, Hover.
Don, you used the word esoteric a couple of times. I just want to be sure. we probably know what the esoteric meaning is of esoteric. But whether you are using it to mean complexity,
well, I just
or more like spiritual force.
No, I mean something more non-physical and amorphous and harder to find. So I just probably wasn't careful at all. When I'm around you, it always sharpens my, you know, I have to be a little more careful with my over.
Yeah, right. Because not everybody is into esotericism.
No, it was not. It was a non-religious comment. It was just more like.
I got you there.
How do we develop imagination, inspiration, intuition in people?
Sense,
strictly economically, so that they come into the market and they see something no one else has saw before. Next thing you know, we got Microsoft Office, which unleashes, I mean, hundreds of trillions of dollars in real productivity gains, saves us so much time. How can we even function without it now, right? So that's what I'm trying to get at, is if you take the physical, if you work backwards in the economic process, you have this labor, you have this intelligence and skills working on labor, organizing it. You go back further, you have labor on the physical world, the physical instruments. You go back behind that, what's behind that? Like nothing, and there's a stream of something that we're cultivating in education and skill development and capacity development, which, where did it come from? I don't mean it, it's not religious in the sense I'm meaning it. I'm meaning imagination, intuition, inspiration. How do we develop that is not a linear answer. It's not an easy question, but we need those capacities to show up. We want to optimize for those capacities in the economy so that we can raise the standard of living.
No, I think your sense of education there is really very valuable. That I would call it, like, you know, imaginative perception or imaginative projection. You know, things are not like clear-cut facts already in front of us. There's an enormous amount of imagination that goes on in even understanding very basic things.
Well, I think everybody on this call has those faculties, or they wouldn't be on this call, right?
Yeah, true.
Something that is not easily seeable.
True. Yeah, and we're teaching each other, you know, these perceptive, imaginative, perceptive capacities while, you know, doing our dialogues.
Yeah.
The other part besides this, I want to bring up. We discussed this thing of how best to allocate debt-free money. I'd like you to address that a little more, because you and I think you in this discussion you brought it up. It's like, you know, there are parts of regions or parts of industries that are undercapitalized and some are overcapitalized, and you talked about a heat map.
Yeah.
And I can see that let's say for where we're now with a lot of poverty, dividends or you know, straight giving people money, you know, straight to them, that will be really good for the economy. But let's say we caught up with you know, the bad side, that the calibration has to become more subtle. And you talked about the heat map, and I thought that was a very good and intriguing idea as a visual. Maybe you want to talk about that a little bit to get us to get a sense of, you know, if there's money to be spent debt-free into the economy by Congress, you know, how best we can do that indeed to get the best buck, you know, literally the best bang for our buck.
Okay.
Without making war.
Now, this is going to conclude my opening remarks in reviewing the questions. And we're going to have more questions. I'm going to go back to this framework so I can pull out and do exactly what you said. I said earlier, we have to be razor sharp on this. Do we want the government to issue money or not? And we're not often clear enough on it. And, you know, if we spend enough time thinking about it, about the debt ceiling and how crazy, you know, if we give them a political tool, they'll wield it. So we don't want that. So there's an old quote by John Dahlberg Acton. We all know it, but this is the longer version, so I'll share it with you guys. I cannot accept your canon that we are to judge Pope and King unlike other men, with a favorable presumption that they did no wrong. If there is any presumption, it is the other way, against the holders of power, increasing as the power increases. Historic responsibility has to make up for the want of legal responsibility. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Why are we reading this? If we put a button somewhere that says, we make money here, the first thing that happens on day one is people with money aggregate around that button and figure out how to influence it. We can't centralize anything in today's world. Now, we used to build cities point periphery, and I think now what's happening with the Apple Store is just one idea, Uber, all these technologies, is the periphery is smarter than the point. And the periphery gives us more information than we could possibly generate from the point. And we need models that go away from centralized systems like sewer systems and create decentralized systems like solar or on-site power. And for this reason, that we are not only, we're talking about money, we're really getting to the root in the, you know, to the root of power. And, you know, we're gonna meet some adversaries if they're gonna come out of the woodwork if we're successful. So I think we want to design something where the government doesn't issue, somebody else does. Your guys' terminology there is monetary authority, and I'm fine with that. but I want it to be decentralized. And how do we actually issue money in a decentralized way? And what's the benefit of that? So let me go back to this is future vision, okay? If we could, right? If we start to look at individuals and we say, what if people have something close to a right to capital? And what if we, now, people always get into the corruption, so let's leave any corruption out for now, or even abuse the system. If we capitalize a bunch of businesses and a bunch of people, we can, even if they don't pay us back, it doesn't matter if the money is for productive use cases. Because they create values, they just didn't create enough values to pay us back. So, but they're creating more skills and more capacities with that capital, so they're more skilled at the end of the process than they were when they started, in theory. Okay, so let's look at the problem that we've described. We're creating too much money for assets, and we're not creating enough for real productive use cases. So let's take a heat map. Let's look at every industry in the United States. Let's look at it regionally. And let's look at what is overheating and what is too cool. And we use data for this. And we could create a map, a heat map that might say, well, the West Coast, we've got housing overheating. So the first question is, how do we siphon some capital off of that? How do we quit pouring gas on that fire by not giving as much capital to that industry? Now, long way to go on the proper delivery mechanism, but two obvious partners there would be local financial institutions, banks, credit unions, public banks, and also industry associations like the Dairy Council, right? People who care about the product or the infrastructure for a certain industry. And so if we deployed capital through the industry association that was too cold, something that needed more capital, needed more infrastructure, we could optimize the productivity in that industry. And if we cooled off capital, maybe through associations, say, hey, sharpen up your priority through your projects, or maybe the banks, we say, hey, sharpen them up. We've got too much going in here. Only the best get through now, or something. We could then issue our money based from the bottom up into the real economy for productive use cases, and we could manage it. We could slow bubbles down before they started, and really equally as importantly, we could finally address chronically undercapitalized geographies or industries or regions of the country. So just like that infinity pool, we could keep pumping money in micro amounts, very targeted, based on data, and we would lift the economic boats where the areas are too cool. And whether it's an industry or geography, we could also tone down things that were overheating by starting to get stricter. And I first had the idea maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I was working with an economist for Kings County, and then I realized we could put that in an algorithm, like a bunch of train cars, and each little mathematical equation, which is the way in econometrics, it's the way we actually build formulas to predict the future economic. We have all these variables that go into these little components. So we came up with this idea that we could create an algorithm that could learn from its mistakes and learn from itself and ultimately optimize that. But the starting point was that algorithm would always be run by people who were looking at the data and looking at the results and saying, hey, we're not getting what we want. But that was a little picture of the future that I think is such a better way to manage money than what we do today.
But you would have still a little bureaucracy before you have the perfect algorithm there.
Well, you always want human beings to intervene. But the thing you could do is you could issue in real time that way. Or at least that would be the hope and the promise. There's all the computing. One, we have massive amounts of data. And two, we have all the computing power we need to do that. I also think no matter what system you have, you're going to have social policy, politics, that says either these things are okay or we want them to happen. Because where people are today, what they think is capitalism is a little bit distorted by this financial economy that has given people too much purchasing power and financial power at the expense of everybody else. So I don't know. That's the picture. Is that what you wanted me to share?
Yeah, and I think it was pretty clear.
John, I have a question. You had talked a little bit about real estate assets. I have one point. It seems I sell real estate. It seems like a lot of real estate prices are also driven by population and density, and that the denser the place is, the harder it is to find a house, and the more expensive the housing is. I think you said in D.C., New York, San Francisco, L.A., places like that. So, but with that in mind, you had talked about removing some of those assets, I guess, out of it and deflating that market. I want to know why. I understand why that's an issue under the current system, and that those resources cannot go to what you're calling the productive economy and productive skills. Why would that be? Do you think that would be the case under monetary reform when you don't necessarily have a scarcity model? So let's say I'm very, very rich and I buy a new yacht every year just because I have that kind of money and that's what I want to do. And so that money is just sitting in assets and I have, you know, let's say a half a billion dollars in properties and just houses everywhere that I can't possibly live in. Do you think that's a problem under monetary reform, or should we just be concerned about the productive economy and not necessarily worry as much about assets? Because I hear in our conversations a lot, we still, even with monetary reform, I think some of us still have an inclination to say, well, you still shouldn't have all that money, so give some of that back still, because we can't have you hoarding money. And so I guess the question is hoarding money or assets a problem in your outlook of monetary reform? This is with monetary reform, not currently, but with monetary reform.
No, it's a perfect lead-in to, I don't believe you can fix the system unless you address this. And here's why. The problem to me is not debt. It's this type of debt. And the reason it's such a problem is it transfers purchasing power. So every day, everybody's going to work creating the GDP of this country. It's being transferred through that non-productive debt. And that is allowing people to live, hey, if you want to be down and dirty about it, is living on the backs of everybody else, right? And that's a really antisocial place to be. Now, I first ran into something like this when I was in Silicon Valley and there was this family that made $1 billion. And you think, well, you know, there's no way they're going to spend that. And they got these kids and they're going to give it to their kids and their kids are going to spend it to their kids and all this. And so it's very distorting. Having said that, and I'm glad we're not live with tomatoes in the audience, because I say something that seems to be unpopular with a lot of people. But I don't really believe that you should tax it from people away on death or something. I struggle, but here's the thing. Is the government more effective with that capital than the people who manage it? So I don't think like government taking the money is really productive. It might be socially advantageous to reduce debt or something where we don't have to tax as much, but it's kind of wasting the capital. And if you think of capital as being precious, you really don't just want to like be not, you want to optimize it. So who can do, who can be better with the capital? You know, I tend to think that people in the private sector. However, I'm very disturbed by this problem.
I want to make sure you understand that my question is really about post monetary reform and our assets a problem. I understand now.
Okay.
So this is assuming that government is already creating money, some act has been passed.
Yeah.
Our assets and hoarding of resource or capital under monetary reform, where the government is creating its own issue and its own money, do you see that as an issue?
That money will disappear in 3 years anyway, so.
Say what?
I said that money will disappear in 3 years under your demurrage.
It could, and it may not have any change in value, but it may change 1%. And right. Also, it'll start differentiating itself, because that's what money does. It'll go into ecosystems where, anyway, it gets complicated, but I think it will start to behave. If you segment it, it'll start to behave differently. It'll start to behave like it naturally would. So Mark's point, let me give you just a kind of a tragic answer. It is possible that you could have been issuing money the entire time. And although your debt level would be different, you might have the exact same social inequality. In fact, it could be worse. You could print money and it could be worse. And I don't think anybody's really thought that through. I'm not saying it will be worse. What I'm saying is there's nothing to address this problem of creating money or, as Hobart says, aggregating your money power to take a disproportionate amount of the money that we do create and pulling it, which is what's happening today, right? This is happening through debt. We don't see it as easily. But imagine we printed the perfect amount of money and the people at the top took most of it. And the people on the periphery said, wait. Now we don't have the money for the local bakery. Well, that's really risky. We don't want to lose the money, right? There's another bakery down the street. We're going to go ahead and aggregate at the top, because where money goes is when it figures out an edge, arbitrage, or it understands the rules of the game, asymmetrical information, and then it goes and makes more money on that. So if you don't stop that problem, every time you've had commodity money, the people that own the commodity or can control the commodity, they get really, really wealthy. So, you know, it's not a cure-all just to issue all the money. You have to.
I think a lot of us would also say that there are quite a few other policy positions that need to come into it. You have to have a living wage. You have to have other things that actually push money back down to the bottom. Is this Hobart sharing something? I think I've seen Hobart.
Yeah, I just put it up because he said something that it was an intriguing thing, but it addresses some of all this, you know, kinds of debt that's around and where it is non-productive and why it is non-productive. But you know, if John wants to comment on it, feel free. Otherwise, I'll just take it away again.
No, I'll comment. I can't see it because I don't have the right thing clicked. Can you read it to me?
You should be able to see it. What? How do you have your screen set up?
I just see everybody on the right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Huh. And at this moment, I don't see it either as sharing. I'm putting it pause sharing, and now I'm resuming sharing, but I don't see anything.
I see it, but.
Okay. Well, one of the things is that you know, John was talking about three kinds of debt, but I think there are four kinds, because if you have a so-called double polarity, you've got debt that starts with existing capital, and there is debt that starts with capital that's loaned into existence. That's the first polarity. And the second polarity is, well, how do you spend it? Is it for productive purposes or is it for non-productive purposes? And John is making the case that you know, as long as there is not a mechanism that keeps the non-productive purposes under control, even with monetary reform, you might still end up with economic problems and inequality.
It's possible mathematically that it's worse, because what Wall Street does is figures out how to control the levers of power. And if they could, if you have the perfect monetary supply, at some point there's no more. And if they misappropriate it, that means somebody's not going to get their what was perfectly distributed or perfectly issued to go to them. They're going to affect distribution, right? That's the point. Is if they can, they will, and they'll do it to make money. But having said that, there is something different about speculating with existing capital and speculating with debt capital. It's mathematical. And what it is the capital that exists in the world is in balance with the assets in the world. And when you create new money to buy assets, you're changing that purchasing power. You still can speculate with existing capital. You can still abuse the system. And in fact, history shows you that is exactly what has happened throughout time, is people with access to money use it. They make money off of it, and there's not access. That's what really concerns me about any centralized, even the Fed, as we might think of a centralized system. You know, it's built out of 12 different regions. It could be a lot more decentralized. Somebody said, most of the big banks are making most of the loans. That's true. I'd like to decentralize the power of the banks. And in my world, which follows Dr. Berner, is the credit unions and the local and regional banks are the epicenter of lending. So let me give you a quick picture. Everyone on this call who has a mortgage, or if you're renting, the mortgage of your landlord, it's not in the state you live. That money is not there. Your retirement is not in the city that you live. Your savings account is not in the city you live unless you're in a credit union or local bank. All of our financial wealth, insurance policies, which are a big deal for certain types of insurance policies, life insurance, all these things, none of these are money that's working in your own economy. They're not raising the standard of living of your neighbors and or yourself. They're all flowing to the financial centers, first the bigger cities, and then over to New York. And
yeah, we have a couple more questions, one from Paul and one from Mark before we have to get out of here. Go ahead, Paul and Mark.
Okay, this is actually related to what you were just talking about. I'm concerned about what local banks can do in terms of distribution of money by themselves without providing first, especially for public purpose I'm talking about, like roads and all the things, infrastructure, unless there's first demand created by government spending. Government has to provide the market for these companies to want to borrow so that they can tool up and capitalize. They're not going to tool up if there aren't incentives for doing solar conversion for your home. The government has to provide that first. Then I can see local governments having a market to lend to, but without government spending as being first. And I think that also controls this inequality of wealth, because government is first directing it to where we need it. And of course, the wealthy will always be able to skim off, like you say, but I think that'll be hampered by the fact that government spends first, creates the market, and then we can lend into the private economy to support that market. That's the way I see it. I just don't see local banks by themselves as being a panacea. I see them as being part of a system that's fueled by government spending.
Well, let me show you. So we had some things intermixing there. So one, when I said local banks, what I'm thinking is, if you set the money supply, now you have a distribution issue. If you just say, whoever wants it can have it, it's probably going to get, Wall Street's probably going to take too much of it, right? But if you know, like this act says, a quarter of it goes to the states, I don't know what the formula is. I don't think there's a static formula. But the point is, if that, what Wells Fargo and B of A and Chase, what none of them do today is make loans under $250,000 into your real economy, unless they're over, unless there's over collateralized. You know, if someone's just saying, I have a bunch of assets, loan me some money against them. But they're not growing your local economy. So we have all of our money in Portland, where I am. It's not growing this economy. It's getting going into national banks, and then they're creating $9 for every dollar, and then they take that onto Wall Street, and they make their money on it. And it's just an electronic credit on their settlement trade account. How much leverage can they do for themselves? So it's a massive part of the reason that we're undercapitalizing local economies and people. So we'd love to have that come in through the local economy. We think that local bankers and local credit unions can play a part, a much more active part, in directing capital to productive use cases in real economies. Now, let me go back to the solar.
No, let's get in. Let's get in Mari's question too, and then you can kind of answer them both at the same time.
Again, okay.
Before we get too late, go ahead, Mari.
Hi, thank you. I misspelled my own name on the chat. But I think, you've been answering this, but since I put the question, but I just wanted you to talk more about the structure of like what your solution would consist of, how a decentralized system would work. So is that I would find in Dr. Werner's materials and proposals?
Well, he emphasizes credit guidance, which is really the simple answer is when we got rid of Glass-Steagall, we created a lot more problems than we realized. So, you know, putting those types of barriers up. Credit guidance is laws that govern what you can do with this right that we've given you. It's not carte blanche, right? So that would be policy, that, you know, how to create policy. I'm not going to tell you I have the answers, because my goal was to highlight some of the problems. Some, a lot of people knew. Some are really, Mark's writing books, a lot of other people, Hovert, and a lot of people on this call are experts, you know? So we learn from each other, and nobody has all the pieces. My goal was to highlight, if you don't solve real estate, if you don't stop all this money going into real estate, if you don't stop investors from going into real estate who are owning property that then somebody else is creating the economic values to pay, you're distorting prices. You're making real estate way more expensive. So what would happen to the quality of our lives if all of our housing prices were suddenly cut in half? We have more money to go out to eat, more money for shows and the arts, more money to donate, you know, spur the real economy. But we are being enslaved financially, because as soon as we make more money, it's going into real estate. And then there's creates a new baseline, and you try to stay where you were at, you can't, because all the housing and rents went up. So this is fundamentally connected to the monetary system. If you want to heal the monetary system and get a better social outcome, you have to address real estate. And the way that, in my view, you would look at doing it is, whether it was the Federal Reserve or the Monetary Authority, you would get rid of incentives for investors to buy properties, and you would basically let the price get set by the people who want to buy a house, and the house is available. And that's not what you have today. And I'd probably
a quick question. Just saying that, like I said, I sell real estate, so I deal with this all the time. So you're basically saying that it's the extra value with something like, if somebody, and this is just a solution right quick that I wanted to get your opinion on. So if there's a real estate market, the best baseline I've ever seen for what a house is worth is what is that house's replacement value.
That's a good insight. And even that's being affected by the level of false values we have in the world today, because all those contractors have to live in those houses as well. So go ahead.
So I say that because if there was a, I forget, I call them underwriting requirements four houses. You called them, what did you just call it? The conditions of how people can lend. You said it was in response.
Oh, credit guidance.
Credit guidance.
Yeah, underlying requirements.
Credit guidance. So if credit guidance said that a bank can only lend for the replacement value of a house, anything else that comes into that house has to come from real money.
If I bought a house,
the replacement cost of $400,000, but because of the market, they wanted $1.5 million, and I had to come up with $1.1 million. Would that address what you're talking about?
Well, I would be concerned for this reason, because then you'd push the market back into people that had capital. What I would say is go the other way, which would be if you took all the incentives for holding real estate and renting it out, you have this huge problem. I don't know if you guys know about this. But in London, in Vancouver, in Seattle, in San Francisco, in New York, people are treating houses as a commodity. They're buying a lot of houses, big houses, multi-million dollar houses, condos, and no one's living in them. So they have these neighborhoods in London where they can't keep a coffee shop open because there are only one or two people that live there, and all the others are empty 50 weeks out of the year. They won't even Airbnb them because they think that's going to wear them down. They're literally storing wealth in these properties. They have a special laws now in Vancouver and Seattle to try to stop this from happening because the remaining housing is shooting up in pricing and there's no place to rent. In Portland, they have this crisis. They call it a rental emergency. But all of this is due to the financial incentives in real estate for people who are not the primary owner, the people who do not live there. Sorry. So you have an owner.
You know what we did in Amsterdam in the 1980s, not?
What's that?
To address that problem. You know what we did in Amsterdam in the 1980s?
What did you do?
Squatting.
Yeah, exactly. I just heard this is happening on the rise too. But having said that, why in the world do we have, we the people, have the money? If housing, if we think of it as getting close to a right, and we have the right to make money, why do we have to go to the market and find that money? Let me give you an example. What if the Federal Reserve or the Monetary Authority or whatever just said, we're going to give money, we're going to create a huge pool of money for real estate, so you can get rid of Fannie Mae and all that, which is also screwing up the market because it's a government guarantee for private investors. It's like, why are we insuring investors' homes? That, I mean, it makes no sense. But anyway, and what if the interest was like 2%? Now, some people will say zero. I'm fine with that. The reason why the Fed likes 2% growth is if you buy your house and you pay on it, you like to see it go up in value because it's probably most people's number one asset. But it doesn't really matter. We should section out the capital for real estate. Should be totally poured out. You know, if you're going to create the monetary system, you create the money for housing. And then you know what you can do? If you're a teacher, you're approved. You know, if you're a first-time home buyer, you're approved. Just, you don't have to worry about, you know, if you can't make your payment, you can re-amortize over 40 years or sell to somebody else. But you can create so much. You can turn renters into owners on the bottom so much more easily, and you can take the commoditization. Now, Paul, you weren't here. Are you still there? He left.
Oh, he's still there.
Still here.
Last time I said this, hey, 1/6 of the land on planet Earth is owned by one person. Think about that.
Wait a
minute. It's the Queen of England.
Oh, I figured you were going to go either that or the back.
Now, you guys are on your computers. Go ahead and Google it and test it. Now, here's the thing. That shows you that land is really first acquired by might, by armies, and then it's handed out as a right to the nobles who helped fight and support it and finance it. And we're trying to get out of that Middle Age mentality, and we have got to make disincentives for people to hold a bunch of property that they don't use, they don't let anyone use, and they're just speculating on it, and they can go to the bank and create this money to do it.
So are you familiar with, what is Dan's group? Is that the Georgians? Is that Dan Sullivan?
I don't know.
The Georgists.
Georgists. I don't know a lot about them, but I know they advocate a lot for property taxes, I believe. I think, Stephen, you know quite a bit about the Georgists, don't you? Dan?
Yeah. What would you like? I just got on. Sorry.
Exactly what their premise was. I know it has to do with property taxes and using property taxes to ensure that people don't hold too much real estate. I'll let you explain because I'm not quite clear on it.
I'm not sure I am too. Nick Tiedemann is a big person. Sue is here on the line, and she would be good. And her friend Alan is president of the Georgia Society. But basically what I know is that it's based on land values. Everything is centered around the land. And so, yes, the land should be taxed, and it's society based on land and land values. I'll just put it like that right now.
Let me throw something else in that's happening with farmland, is the commodity value of land. So in my scenario, land doesn't have any economic value. Now, that really confuses people. That gets them upset. But it's not until the human being engages with the products of nature. Even if you're gathering firewood, it's will coming into contact with nature that creates economic values. So I don't want to get stuck on that because it's a little bit difficult. But the point is, what we have today is a farmer can no longer buy a property and farm and make a living on the West Coast, like California. And if you've had a farm for a long time and you try to sell it, it's worth one price as a farm, but it's worth a totally different price if you break it up and put houses on it. And so some of the best farmland in the world is just getting broken up constantly and putting houses on it. And they're saying, oh, go to the non-productive land in the worst part of the state or the area around here and go farm over there because that's the only land that's cheap enough. And we have a real problem that family farms are being destroyed and we're being lost, and we really need to find a different way to lock the certain amount of farmland into farm trusts where somebody would come in and farm it and make a living in a retirement, and when they're done, you don't sell it, you let a new farmer come in. So that's when you take the means of production and you lock it in for the community in some sort of trust. That's another problem with the current way we're handling real estate. But just to conclude that original idea, if you have credit guidance and you have government issuing its own money and you have some sort of dividend, those are the building blocks. But also you have to have a separate pool of capital and create all disincentives for investors so that the financing for real estate is not impacting the money supply the way it is today.
Maura has one more question before we get ready to shut it down. Now, go ahead, Maura.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you get on the stack? I thought I said.
Yes, thank you. Could you just explain a little bit more about the how you would do what you were just talking about, how you would transition from this bubble and this mess we have now with real estate into something that works and is sane?
Okay. I will tell you, these are not expert views, right? I'm just one person in the circle, right? We're all trying to learn together and come up with better outcomes, right? We don't have all the solutions, but if we don't really get clear on the problem, we're going to create the solution to something that isn't the problem, and we're not going to get the outcome we want. So, having said that, real estate, I just think it's a matter of you have to change the laws to create disincentives. One of the things they're doing in Seattle now is they've created a new tax that if you don't live in the house, you got to pay a tax. So guess what? People who own houses that don't live there, they sell them. And now all of a sudden all the supply comes back on the market. Or if they want to hold them, they pay, and that goes into their affordable housing program. So I'm not up to date on it because I heard it when it was a proposal and people were enraged, but something like this, Vancouver and London's probably the worst city than Vancouver. and Seattle. It's happening a little bit in all down the coast, and I think these things are going to happen. But the general guiding principle is change all tax policy that does not create, so you eliminate incentives to buy real estate. A huge portion of the tax law is buried with little deals for doing real estate. So you got to get rid of all that stuff so you don't have the incentives for investors to step in. And then you create your monetary authority would just create a separate pool of capital for real estate, and it would basically make it very easy for people to buy houses. It wouldn't be quite as difficult.
So, like capital gains taxes, is that what?
Kind of well, what remember, if we taxes are always tricky for this reason. These taxes wouldn't be capital gains, the ones we talked about. It would simply be, in the course of a year, they monitor your power and all this other stuff. If it's not your primary residence, and you don't spend a certain amount of days in the town, that you have to pay a tax on it. I'm not sure that's the best example. I'm just telling you that's what they've done. Because the thing is, if you print your own money, you have the ability to eliminate taxes, right? So as much as you got a lot of headwinds, there's been times in this country where the populists have populist political uprising. I mean, if you tell everyone in this country that you're going to take their taxes to 10%, and if they donate 10%, there's going to be zero taxes. You're going to issue money. A lot of people aren't going to care. They're not going to listen any farther than that. They're going to agree with you. They're going to want that policy. And that's a strategy for implementing some of these reforms. So, but in that environment, taxes aren't really the tool that they are today. I would just say you want to get rid of tax incentives, and you want to disincentivize investors owning and holding properties, and you want those properties to shake out for actual homeowners. Problem with that is it's going to lower the price of housing. So your best chance to implement that is during the next downturn. And during the last downturn, if all they had done is let people go into 40-year mortgages, like the Fed had an emergency last stop mortgage, they could have kept all millions of people lost their homes that never should have, But those homes were too expensive because they were doing these loans where you didn't have to put any money down, and then you didn't have to have any credit, the ninja loans. NINA loans, no income, no assets, and that just gave more and more purchasing power. Basically, anyone could go to the bank, sign their name, and buy a house. If they said, I literally did a loan once, and the guy said, we were going through our income, and he said, does your wife have income? Do you have any other income? Because if this number says 8,000 right here, you're going to get the house. I think right now, might not. And I was just like, you want me to put 8,000 down there? He's like, well, you probably have other income. And I was like, yeah, okay. So then he wanted me to put it down there. And I was just like, so I put that down there, I'm going to get the house. He's like, that's the way it works.
Yeah, that's very true. I know when I was still selling real estate during the downturn, and I would often take out clients, and I would have an idea of what these people made. And literally, the mortgage may be 65% of their salary. So I don't even know what their front end and back end ratios were. But I was like, you're going to get in trouble. One thing happens, you're going to lose this house. And certainly a lot of them did, too. Well, it's
San Francisco climbed over 70% of people's incomes they were spending on housing.
That's crazy. It's 10:20, so I want to thank John for a good conversation and to let us know your thoughts and incorporate that into our thinking. I think there's a lot to discuss. I know we've talked a couple of times over email, but I think, honestly, I think that the more people we can point out critiques of monetary reform, the better it is for us. Because I think, like John mentioned, that once monetary reform gets a good showing, and it's something that's seriously talked about, there'll be a lot of people who have a lot of serious critiques that we have to be able to respond to with appropriate policy discussions or appropriate thoughts that we've thought about of ways you can handle it, handle the situation that comes up too, or the critique, if you will. So I think this is always good. I would encourage everybody to think about the things. I don't think anything should be defensive. I always think that if somebody says it's a problem, it's probably a problem. And it's something that we just need to think about and incorporate. Like we've always said, I think some of us are purist monetary reformists and just want to do the three pillars of change. And other ones are like, well, no, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that you got to talk about too, especially when you're dealing with macroeconomics. And so I think John's conversation is going to point to that level, that there are other things we need to think about to make sure that if we do monetary change, that we do it the right way, because we are certainly only going to get one crack at it, I would imagine, in the public eye.
Mark, can I just throw one thing in there that I meant to say for, I think it was Mary. My personal, which is not an expert view, is just I would try to transform what is there rather than create new institutions, if possible. So in my world, it would be much better to transform the Fed than create a new monetary authority. And it would be much better to try to just cover government spending than it would be to all the money, because I think politically and practically, you're not, it's really hard to get rid of the Fed, not as hard to reform it. It's going to be really hard to get all the money, and I actually think it's detrimental, but so I'm being transparent. But I think it'd be a lot easier just to get the government money. And I actually think the best thing to do would be focus on something like infrastructure and try and do, I really like to be transparent and open, but I just got to tell you, this is the way the system works today, is do some kind of law where they tell the Fed to do whatever they've got to do to create a pool of $200 billion a year for infrastructure, whether they tell them they have to sell bonds or whatever. Now, that'll freak everyone out because they like the independence of the Fed, but that's a hell of a lot softer than what we're talking about. And if you could just get some, if you could just break that line and get a program for infrastructure where the Fed was selling bonds, and which is basically issuing money, it's just doing it through the Fed, then these other ideas aren't going to be that far off anymore. It's not going to be like, you know, you went from A to Z, it's when you went from A to B, and then next day, B is actually C, and you're on a slippery slope where you could slowly start to reform it. But that's just my practical idea, because I want to get something done, and I know some people are committed to the whole enchilada, and that's great too, but it's, you know, that's all my two cents.
Thank you. I like that idea, except for the bond part. If they're giving the money, I'd like that idea, but the bond part, you lost.
Well, here, all I'm saying is this. The Fed owns all these T-bills. Now, what happens when we pay the interest on the T-bill is the Fed actually gives it back to us. So it is, for the degree that they, for any debt that the Fed holds, we really aren't, we really don't pay that debt. I mean, we make the service payments, and then they, by law, have to give it back to us. But they don't announce that because they don't want China to get upset and stuff, but I've actually seen it on the national budget, a line item from the interest from the Treasury. What I'm saying is, if they went out and sold $200 billion of bonds, they'd have $200 billion of cash. Today, when they do that, it's on their balance sheet, it just disappears. But if we said, oh, we want you to set it aside, then it's just like the Treasury issuing money. You're basically, you're turning those bonds into cash, for, which you've already issued the bond. It's not like issuing a new bond. You're taking the bonds they bought in the open market, and when they sell them, you're saying, don't put that back on your balance sheet and make it disappear. Put it in our Treasury account so we can do infrastructure. That's all.
Steven, we're about to close out.
I know. I just wanted to apologize for coming so late. I had two 95-year-old women waylaid me tonight. Was there a recording made of this?
No, unfortunately, it wasn't, because we couldn't figure out who logged in originally, so I couldn't record it.
But all your questions were answered.
We did go over your questions. And Stephen, we opened the meeting thanking you for the summary and organizing the questions.
Okay, well,
I think I have one of your questions. Let me just make sure I got them all. Well, I guess we're running out of time.
Okay. Well, I noticed who's on the line, and I may try to contact some of you just to be debriefed a little bit. And I thank you, too. And as Mark pointed out, everyone being interested in monetary reform from having different critiques and different perspectives is a healthy thing. I still think I'm a little bit of a purist when it comes to my background and training, but I've learned a lot from you, John, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. And I said, Stephen, before you came on, nobody has the answers. I knew Bernard Lee there. I spoke with him extensively. I know a lot of people. I don't have all the answers. I never met anybody that does. We have to keep sharing to uncover the deeper truths. That's the only way we'll get there is together.
Good. We agree with that.
Thank you. Well, with that, I will bid you all adieu. Everybody have a good evening, and we will see you guys soon.
Thank you all. I really appreciate you giving me the time and being engaged in this. Your effort is what will make it happen. So thanks.
Thank you, John. That was great.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.